If you want this podcast free of ads, follow us now on patreon.com/David McWilliams.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It's podcast time. I hope all is well. And the weekend has been fine, and the week ahead is even finer. How are you, Ed?
I'm good.
You've been good this week?
I have been as good as I possibly could be.
Under the circumstances.
Under the circumstances. But what have you been reading this week? I know you've had your head stuck in books.
Yeah, no, I've been down here in the basement. I've been full of books.
Yeah.
I've been reading a bizarre book, John. Bizarre, but really brilliant
surprise,
book.
Surprise.
Called The Merchant of Prato, The Daily Life in a Medieval Italian City, by Iris Origo, right?
Lovely.
So it's The Daily Life in a Medieval Italian City. And the reason I'm fascinated by this is I am now not obsessing about, but I'm trying to do a piece of work on the extraordinary exuberance of Italian merchant cities in the early medieval period. Now, the reason I'm doing this...
Yeah, I was going to say, the next question is why?
Why? Because these were fulcrums of innovation. These were unbelievably curious places. So you think about Italy. I've always thought that geography matters a lot to economics.
Oh, yeah.
So think about Italy. It's like this big old boost that sticks out in the middle of the Mediterranean, mm-hmm. right? So everything that goes through the Mediterranean has to either land or depart from Italy. And particularly back then when the sea was the main thoroughfare, right?
Yeah.
So I'm interested in why the Renaissance happened in Italy. This has been intriguing me for many, many years.
Right.
Why was it?
Why in Italy and not in Spain
and
or
in
France?
In Spain or in Germany
or Britain,
you know, even in Ireland, God forbid, right? Because we were very far away from the action.
Well, there was a mini Renaissance, though, in the 800s under Charlemagne. In Germany, France.
There was. I don't know, Charlemagne is something you've
obsessed about
for many years.
Charlemagne, yeah.
But no, so I'm interested in, so I'm looking at the 21st century economy. Mm. And what's going on, and where all the nodes of innovation are happening. And you have the Silicon Valley, and now the Silicon Valley people are going to Texas. And now, I'd say, why does it happen in certain areas, right?
Yeah.
So I went back to the first place it really happened, which was Florence in the 1400s. 1300s, 1400s.
Yeah.
My friend Dante and all those carry on, right? And what I'm trying to figure out is, why did it happen there? And this book is about this extraordinary character called Francesco Daniti, who was the merchant of Prato. And what he left was an unbelievable library of notes and letters about his business. So he starts this business in Avignon
What was France.
He was a trader. He was a merchant.
In anything in particular?
In everything. This is
Everything.
He started originally.
He's a proper corner shop.
But he started as a corner shop. And the interesting thing, he maintained his corner shop. Now, the point is that what intrigues me is how these people expanded their extraordinary network of commerce all around the world, all around the known world. And then that got me thinking about what currency they used.
Yeah.
And they used a gold currency called the Florentian florin, right? And then it got me thinking about what we were talking about last week, which was
Bitcoin.
Bitcoin and this idea of digital gold.
Yeah.
And the idea that the Bitcoiners and the cryptocurrenciers and all these people think digital gold is a really good thing. So they say it's digital gold because gold is a good thing.
Yeah.
And so I went back to the era where gold was actually
the thing.
The currency.
Yeah.
Right? And the reason I mentioned our friend Dante is that Dante reserved the eighth circle of hell for somebody who debased the gold currency. A poor lad called Adam, who actually happened to be English in the inferno.
Right? How did he debase the
coin? Well, because you see, what happened was the gold currency. Now, this goes back to the Bitcoiners and their, you know, their extraordinary obsession with the purity of currency. So Adam, God bless him, right, tried to debase the Florentine florin. And what he did was that you'd put copper into gold. So you'd, you'd get the gold currency, get loads of them, you'd melt it down. You'd put copper in, you'd take out the gold. So it would be not 100% gold, it would be 60% gold. And you'd pass it off as this new currency.
And this, by the way, goes back to what you were saying last week about bad currencies elbow out good currencies.
Gresham's Law.
Gresham's Law, that's what it was.
And you know the hotel.
Boom.
You know the hotel, the Gresham? And
yeah.
The Gresham. It's named after Gresham.
Really?
Yes. This is all coming. It's all of a piece, man. It's all.
It seems in Ireland. Gresham's Law. Gresham was Irish.
Gresham's a paddy, yeah. This is all.
Like, right. Okay.
There is a deep, deep seam of economics in Ireland. We don't see it, but there is a historical seam.
Okay.
But let's
good
go back.
Stuff. Go on.
Let's go back. So the idea was debasing the currency. Right? And the Bitcoiners and all the crypto people say this is a disastrous thing, right? And Dante agreed with them, which is why poor old Adam, if you really want to read the Inferno, Adam was down there with the sodomites and the blasphemers, okay? Because sodomy and blaspheming was, for Dante, the worst thing possible. Not as bad as Lucifer, but not that much way. So the point was, I'm trying to figure out, is what was the reason for this obsession with the purity of the currency? And because the merchants loved the purity of the currency.
Sure.
Because they earned the currency.
Yeah.
But then I was thinking about, what about all the other fuckers who lived in Florence? The tradesmen, the craftsmen, the laborers, what did they actually think of it? And then what you do is you go to what happened during the Black Death, right? So Dante is writing 1300. Black Death happens in 1338, right? One third of the European population is destroyed. Okay, die from this thing.
Right.
So the labor force collapses. And you think, what happens? And we're going to talk about pandemics and the reaction to pandemics and something called the Great Resignation later on.
Oh, okay. Sounds good.
About why people are leaving their jobs. But I go back to this idea. Why, what happened during a pandemic with a fixed currency? What you had was the pandemic happens, loads of people die, the labor force collapses. Rather than the currency adjust downwards to take account of the new reality, what adjusted was slavery. So this is the weird thing.
Right, go on.
So the Black Death leads to this enormous increase in slavery in Italy, in Florence. Why? Because the people are dead. They need new people to come in. So the Italians say, okay, well, slavery, you know, as long as it's infidels, non-Christians,
it's all going to
be great. Yeah. So there's one reason that many, many people have always thought of, why do Italians look quite un-Mediterranean? So if you're in Florence, if you're in Turin, if you're in Milan, even if you're in Rome, lots of blonde people, lots of blue-eyed people. And geneticists think it's because after the Black Death, there was a massive increase in slavery from the East, from Russia, from the Caucasus, from the Caspian, from the Tartar republics, people who are slightly Asiatic looking.
Yeah.
And now what you have, they're all blended into the Italian population. And now in Italy, in contrast to Spain, for example, you have an extraordinary percentage of Mediterraneans who don't look like Mediterraneans at all. And the reason is that in the beginning of the Renaissance, you have this amazing injection of different genes coming from slavery. Now, the reason this is interesting is that had the Florentines been able to debase their currency, the currency could have fallen to take in account of the fact that their labor force had fallen and therefore their goods would become cheaper abroad. And they could have actually said, you know what? We have less people working, our goods will come cheaper, and you guys buy them at a cheaper price. But no, they were obsessed by the strong currency.
But it was the fact that it was linked to gold.
And exactly. That,
so it couldn't be devalued.
Devalued. And this comes back to our Bitcoiners. So the thing about the crypto people and the Bitcoiners is it's great to have a new currency, but what happens when things go wrong? How can your currency adjust when, for example, you get hit by a pandemic or you get hit by a recession or a depression?
Yeah.
So again, if you come back to my monetary economics was learned through the prism of the Great Depression. So every person who studied monetary economics or who is studying monetary economics knows that the reason the Great Depression was so long and so profound and so debilitating, leading to Hitler and all these other things, was because they wouldn't devalue their currency. They were obsessed by gold, right? So what I'm saying to Bitcoiners, crypto people, is what happens when there is a crisis? So the crypto people say...
So if crypto was the currency...
of the world.
And no fiat currency...
Yeah. So the, and that, okay. And that's their objective.
Yeah. Okay.
So what happens if there is a crisis, a recession, a default crisis, a depression? What do you do then? Because you have to print money. So what happens in a depression, the Great Depression, was that people got nervous about money and they started to hoard money and money disappeared.
Yeah.
And when money disappears, the whole system coagulates and nothing happens. So Roosevelt, who was for ages saying, oh, we can't come off the gold standard, one morning over a number of weeks said, you know what? This gold is nonsense. You know, Keynes described it as a barbarous relic, gold, right? This obsession with gold. And what Roosevelt said was, you know what? We're just going to print dollars. People are going to believe us. And these dollars are going to be real.
Yeah.
And that's what actually got the world out of depression. So what I'm interested in is, what did the Bitcoiners think would happen in a great
depression? Do they not mine more Bitcoin?
Well, they can't, because they've said there's going to be a cap on it.
Right, okay.
So this is what...
So they lift the cap. I mean, is that going to be a move?
Well, no, because their whole... One of their great big rallying cries is that the cap gives it integrity and you can't change it and the money's... So what I'm interested in is what happens in the crypto world when there's a recession? What happens in the crypto world when there's a pandemic, to go back to our friends, the Florentines?
Yeah.
So can you imagine in a world run by crypto or Bitcoin, where it's a fixed supply of money, if you have a pandemic, and the government says, well, we've got this pandemic, so you've all got to sit in your holes for a couple of months, maybe a year, and you can't work, closing down the society. Okay. The quid pro quo is, okay, if you close down the society and we can't work, we still need income. So what happens in our world is the government says, oh, okay, cool. Well, we're just going to print money. We're going to buy debt with this printed money.
Yeah.
Okay. And we're going to give you money. So what has happened in the last couple of years is people have been given money for free. That's the beauty of fiat currency. It's flexible. And you know my whole obsession that economics is much more evolutionary than engineering.
Yeah.
So in an evolutionary system, the most adaptable product is the one that wins.
Yes, of course.
So if you introduce rigidity into an evolutionary system, you lose, right? You completely lose because once you rigidify or you make calcify your money or whatever, and the system is trying to rotate and trying to churn, and you say, we can't churn, you lose. So what would have happened in a crypto world during the pandemic is the government would have said, you can't work, sorry, but we've no money to give you.
Yeah.
Because we can't print it. So what would have happened? You would have had a national riot all over the world, right? So the thing about the crypto guys is that I get all the tech bro shit. I get all the, you know, we're libertarians and yada, yada, yada. We don't need government. We don't need taxes. We don't know. I understand all that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make any sense in a democracy, because a democracy has to be flexible and has to be able to react to what's going on. And I'll just leave you with one idea before we talk about the great resignation.
Yes.
Well, you and I should resign anyway.
Well, I did many years ago.
We have that job for
you. This is the result.
Exactly. But I'll leave you with this idea that in 1929, the stock market collapsed. The fallout from the stock market collapse was all asset values fell.
Yeah.
When all asset values fall, the people who owe money to the institutions who lend to them have no money, they have no assets, they have no collateral, so they default. When you default in a system that's as complex as our modern system, you get what they call cross defaults, right? So good assets get sold to pay for bad assets. So you get an implosion of the system. Now, if you are obsessed by not printing money during these periods, all you get is a massive, massive amplification of the crisis. Defaults beget more defaults, beget more defaults, etc. And the more defaults you have, the more people who have money hoard money and take it out of the system because they're worried. So you get a perennial depression. That's what happened. And in 1931 and 32, a small man with a mustache claiming to be German, but actually Austrian, said, you know what? You are the people who are suffering. The average person is suffering. You're in default. Vote for me and I will sort everything out. And the historical implication of a fixed exchange rate regime and an obsession with gold or Bitcoin or something like that is that in a crisis, extremists come in.
Yeah.
Now, one of the problems with Bitcoiners is they kind of want this. This is part of their thing. We're going to tear it down. We're going to knock it down. Mm-hmm. What are they saying in these tech bros? Break things and move quickly. Like, fuck off, right? You've got people. You've got people to concern about. You have children. No, seriously. So my sense is that crypto at the moment and Bitcoin is great if you're really rich.
Yeah.
And you're really comfortable. But what happens when you're not? What happens when you're not is the system actually becomes calcified. People get angry. That anger, imagine if we hadn't printed money in the pandemic.
Yeah.
Imagine if we hadn't printed money after the great crash in 2008. What would have happened? So
there wouldn't have been a lockdown because it wouldn't have been possible.
But then you're going to have lots of people killed.
Yeah.
So my point is there is a direct relationship between the Black Death, the Merchant of Prato, and the Bitcoiners. It's not a absolutely straight arc, but it's a meandering story which concludes in the same way, which is if you inject rigidity into your economic system, you will get chaos and weirdness. If you go with the squidgy, messy, fungible notion of printing money, it might not necessarily be pure ideologically, but what it actually does is it saves society in a crisis.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
John, do you know that in the last 5 months, 5 months, 20 million Americans have quit their jobs, right?
Wow.
That's a phenomenal amount. And The last figures we have are in August, because the figure is always a couple of months out.
Yeah.
4.2 million Americans just left their jobs. And one in every 12 people who works in hospitality in America has left their jobs. So the Americans call this thing the Great Quit.
Yeah.
Okay, the Great Resignation. I'm going to give you some other statistics, okay? McKinsey.
Yeah.
Who would never employ you and I.
No. Nor would I want to be employed by them.
A million years, right? But they came out with a report talking about this phenomenon, and they found that 40% of employees are at least somewhat likely to quit in the next 3 to 6 months, not just in America, but in a whole host of countries.
Right.
And in Ireland, survey data in Ireland show that 42% of Irish workers intend to leave their jobs within the next year.
Wow. To go where?
42% want to do this now, as opposed to 21% before the pandemic.
Right.
So the idea is the pandemic has changed people's perceptions of work, people's perceptions of jobs, people's perceptions of permanency, and obviously people's perceptions of what life is all about. Yeah. And this, again, is something that, you know, we thought was this, maybe this idea that it would change, but it's actually happening in the States. And of course, the States has much better data.
And what's the upshot of that then?
Well, the upshot is that people are actually leaving jobs that they felt they had to stay in.
And is this is the crux of the, I mean, we've spoken quite a few times about the labor crisis, the global labor crisis.
So it's not a labor crisis. This is obviously people at work saying, you know what? I don't need, shove your job, stuff your job, yeah, up your jacksy. I'm going to go and do something else.
Right.
No, but seriously. And it's really fascinating, because had you said at the start of the pandemic, remember we started the podcast before the pandemic, but you know, this time last year,
we grew up in the pandemic.
We did. John, you and I, we matured. We became of, do you remember, you know,
we became alcoholics.
We definitely became alcoholics. But you remember the come of age? I don't know if you ever read The Snapper.
I did.
Right, actually, okay. Yeah. And The Snapper was based in Barrytown all around the 1990 World Cup.
That's right.
Right? And one of the great lines in The Snapper, when your man Burgess is trying to avoid the other one, Burgess was the dad.
Yeah, he was the one he got.
And they're watching
the
Dave O'Leary take the penalty against the Romanians, right? And some lad in the pub says, they're all listening, and George Hamilton is the commentator.
Yeah, yeah.
And Dave O'Leary scores, and George Hamilton says, this is to your point of being beat by the child, says, Dave O'Leary came of age today. And your man says, Dave O'Leary is 37. So I know you came of age in the pandemic, but let's talk serious stuff.
I came of age in my 50s.
I know, because we are joined by Rachel Ray. Now, you may not know Rachel, but Rachel, a couple of years ago, I was looking for somebody to help me research Ireland for a book I wrote called The Renaissance Nation.
Yep.
And Rachel was Rachel, how are you? The finest researcher in the whole world.
That's some introduction. But I'll take it.
You have to take it. No, but I mean, we did actually do lots of research together. And now, of course, you've been doing B2B marketing for years and years and years. We were chatting the other night. I said, is this a big thing? Is this a real thing, this great resignation, this big quit? And you said, yeah, it is. It's certainly amongst your generation, it's a real thing. What's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what we're seeing, one of the things I think that's interesting about those stats that you were saying there earlier is that actually it's not a flash in the pan when it comes to those stats. Like, they're repeated over and over. So the McKinsey thing is also repeated by a Microsoft stat that says the same, you know. The stats around stress in the workplace are repeated again and again by the likes of Deloitte and all those other kind of big names there. So there's definitely a trend going on that's consistently found, not just in the US, but across the board. It was a little bit slower in Europe because, you know, we had, you know, payments for people and people had certain supports in place.
Sure. Yeah.
Differentiated from place to place. But ultimately, it's something that we're seeing on an international scale. And it's something that's really scaring companies at the moment, because obviously, you know, everyone's faced a lot of challenges over the last 2 years. For companies, they've had the additional expenses that come with, say, still running during a pandemic, whether it's like you know, that the sort of the hygiene and cleaning factors that come into that, which has had, you know, astronomical costs for stores and things that have kept running, and those then that have had closed down. And now what they're seeing is a talent drain, where they're unable to actually get the workers back in now that things are back up and running again.
So tell me about your generation, because John and I are dinosaurs in this whole thing, right? And also, John and I have never had a proper job, so we're kind of
that's very true.
We're in a kind of a permanent pandemic in our heads, and we have been for years. But you know, in terms of millennials, you know, and the Gen Z and all this, like, is there a sense that there's a total recalibration of what it is about working and what people have to do, the obligations people have to have?
Yeah, I think one of the things you have to remember about millennials as well is we kind of came of age in times of crisis already. So, you know, when I was leaving college, we were in the middle of the recession, you know, and I remember being in UCD at the time, and the speech that was given as we were leaving, you know, the unofficial day was, "The world is your oyster, arts degree students. You go forth and prosper." And then the official, you know, the official day with the official speeches was, "Australia's sure looking good. Best of luck," within a week. And I do think there's a sense with millennials that the world that's been built before us, that's laid before us, whether it's environmental or work related or whatever that is not necessarily the one that we want for ourselves. And work is a big part of that, and how people work and the concept of what working is and how it's done really needs a shaking up.
And this idea of this great quit, because again, as I said before, you know, had you said to people before the pandemic, well, the consequence of this will be people saying we don't need to work anymore, or we're going to take time off or whatever. Is this, I'm putting my old fella hat on here, is this just a function of the fact the labour market after the pandemic has tightened? There are lots of jobs around. There are many more jobs around. There's lots of opportunities. Wages are rising and rising quite rapidly. And your generation is saying, well, maybe I'm just going to take some time out. I mean, what's the data saying? You've done the research on this. What's it saying to us about everything?
Yeah, so like, recently, I'm working with a company called Castus, which is an Irish tech startup company. So it's one of those ones that's in that biotech kind of space. Their whole area is around antibacterial, antimicrobial surfaces. And one of the things that we wanted to look at from a research point of view was this idea of people going back to work. And particularly in the UK, where there was a big kind of song and dance about reopening and the reopening dates and
Freedom Day, please.
Freedom Day. And actually, you know, what workers' attitudes were to that. So these were people that had been able to work at home. And what we found that was 50% of people are still at home, even though we've gone long past Freedom Day.
Which must be this much, much higher here.
Yeah, yeah. And of that, half of them still don't know what their employer's plans are in terms of, are they going to be remote? Are they not? Are they going to be partly in? Are they going to be relocated to another country? Like, there's so many variables going on. And I think there's a lack of sense of control for people, but particularly I think with millennials, because when you look at something like in Ireland with housing markets and, you know, this sense of you're not controlling the roof over your head, you're not controlling, you know, when you came out of college and went off on the back foot, you know, starting into jobs, and now you're in the middle of your career and you're not really feeling in control of that or what you do, when you do it, when you have kids, all of that. So I think that's leading to an awful lot of stress and resentment within the millennial base.
And do you see this, like, you know, this, like, for example, Brexit was about take back control. To a degree, the big Sinn Féin vote is about, you know what, the establishment, you guys have been in power for a while. Now you've had your time. We want our time now. And do you see the same thing, the idea of the great resignation, as people saying, I've bought for the last 10 years the establishment line. It's not actually working for me, and I'm going to opt out. And I'm going to see what happens in 3 or 4 months or a year's time. Do you see it all together?
It's definitely, it feels like it is a sort of vote with feet.
Yeah.
And it reminds me a lot of back in 2010, when it was presumed, obviously, you didn't have a job and that was okay. You know, so there's a permission there as well to kind of take a step back, particularly, I think, after the amount of stress that people have had over the last year and a half. Like KPMG found that 94% of workers are stressed at the moment. And Oracle had said 2020 was the most stressful year to date on record.
Really?
Now, I don't know what they're going to say about 2021.
Yeah, we'll give them 2022.
We did have Trump in 2020, so maybe that might have been a bit of a factor as well there. But yeah, it does feel like it's a reaction to a kind of enough is enough. I'm not getting enough out of this. I've kind of bought into this promise of, you know, be good, go to college, do your unpaid internship for 5 million years, get into work and do all
live
that.
Live with your
and
mummy for all the time and it'll all work out.
Yeah, and it hasn't. And I think there's definitely a sense there with people that they're kind of taking their fate into their own hands.
Do you know, it's kind of surprising and not surprising at the same time. It's not surprising that the millennials are pissed off.
No, it's not.
And you know, after having two of your formative years taken away from you. But then it's surprising that, because it's still such a precarious time. Well, in my mind it is.
Yeah.
For people to go, right, I'm out of here. See you, good luck.
Well, you know? I think, yeah, no, it is. It's I think the big takeaway is that the pandemic has completely changed the labour market. So what you've had, we forget that we've had over $11 trillion worth of stimulus in the last 2 years, right? So that's lots and lots of money in people's bank accounts, right?
11 trillion.
Yeah, that's if you add the whole world together. Right? It's a huge amount, right? So what that's done is that's created maybe a false sense or a real sense of a little bit more security.
Yeah.
Right? The key takeaway for me is, from all this, is you will never get a better chance to get a wage increase, right? So if you are sitting, your employer is prevaricating about a wage increase, be well aware that you're in the ascendancy, right? And now's the time to go looking for wage increases.
Yeah.
Because it's very obvious to me, we've had this massive stimulus, right? We've had, basically we're in what you could probably call a shortage economy, where there's a shortage of stuff, there's a shortage of supply, there's a shortage of everything,
right?
So all these bottlenecks we talked about the last week, these are all emerging. Now is the time to strike for wage increases. This is my Marxist clarion call to the world, right? Because basically now workers are in the driving seat for the first time in ages.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, because, you know, there are still quite a few companies that I know of that haven't reinstated the wage cuts from 2008.
Of course, there are loads. There's loads. I mean, there's loads and loads of people who have never got
so
back to that level.
So at the very least, that should be reinstated.
Well, I think so. The first thing is to look at, right? Look at it through the Marx. I always say it's crucial to start your analysis with Marx, but never end there.
Right.
Because Marx alighted upon a very fundamental idea, right? It wasn't just Marx alighted on this. All economics has for many years. But Marx made it his own. And the idea was that there is only two places money can go, right? So in every product, the split in terms of the income from the product goes either to profits, which is to shareholders, or to wages, which is to workers. Think about that way. Mm. And for the last, since the 2008 crisis, the bias has been towards profits, which is why you've seen the stock markets go through the roof, which is why you see massive corporate buybacks, which you see massive inequality, because the really, really rich have done really, really well. And we've talked about this before, when there's easy money, and if you're very rich, you have the collateral against which to borrow to buy more assets, you can actually hoover up all the assets. So it's not, remember that idea of trickle-down economics?
Yeah.
I call it hoover up economics, right? Yeah. That the rich hoovered up everything. Then the pandemic hits, and we get to a stage where now we have a shortage of workers. We have lots of workers like Rachel and her generation saying, I'm going to try and take back control in a bit. I was sold a dream.
Yeah.
That dream hasn't materialized.
Yeah, yeah.
I now want to think of something else. So that's the big quit, right? But for those people who are still in work, what you see is that at every stage, in every great iteration of economic cycles, the shift between labor and profits, between workers and capital, is the key. And that pendulum swung right in favor of profits for the last 10 years, as we said just now. And now that pendulum is swinging back in favor of wages.
Yeah.
So wages will rise. Now, certain economists you'll hear them talking about wage inflation as if it's dangerous. Wage inflation is excellent. because higher wages are what we should all be here for.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
So some people call it wage inflation. I like to call it economic justice, that basically employees, workers are actually getting their just desserts back a bit, right? That's the first takeaway from that, that the pendulum is swinging towards workers and away from capital, right? In an old Marxist view.
Mm.
Second thing is that this is exactly what we're seeing in policy, right? In policy, we're seeing a big increase in spending, a big increase in investment, a fundamental change in the way in which we're doing business, not just in this country, but in every country. So there's a political trend, there's a social trend, and there's an economic trend. And all of them are bending towards higher wages. And this is the arc. So the arc of justice bends. Who said that?
Judge Dredd.
No. Martin Luther King.
Right.
Great arc of morality bends towards justice, right? Well, the great arc of morality maybe does bend, but it also can be bent by policy, right? And so this is what I think is happening, and that's what Rachel is picking up.
Does this not go back to, you know, as you say, wage inflation and that fear, innate fear of inflation in general? So if you have higher wages, you're going to have higher prices. It's going to push prices up.
Yeah, I mean, there is... Now, it's interesting because on Thursday, we're going to come back to this idea. Not least because over the weekend, it was announced that Jens Wiedemann, now this name might mean nothing to you, the head of the Bundesbank, inflation hawk, has just retired early from the Bundesbank in Germany. And I want to talk about what's happening in Germany with respect to inflation and wages and policy.
He's part of the great quit as well.
Exactly. Except I think he was quite well looked after. Exactly. Jens, exactly. Well, I want to talk to you about that. But some people call wage inflation, I call it economic justice because of what has been happening for the last 10 or 15 or maybe even 20 years. Right? But let's end with the Black Death and pandemics. So what the Black Death showed us is that when the labor market is completely disrupted by a pandemic, things really change. Now, what happened in the Black Death was that real wages, because the labor force contracted because people died, two things happened. One is there was a massive increase in slavery, right?
Yeah.
Which we spoke about earlier on. But the second one is that real wages rose dramatically. Now, it's another strange thing to think of in Ireland. What actually happened after the famine is that real wages rose dramatically in Ireland too after the famine.
Right.
Because people died. And so if you imagine there's no workers, right?
Yeah.
So the workers who remained in Ireland agitated for much higher wages because the people who would have had those wages actually starved. I mean, it's the brutal way in which economics works, right?
Yeah.
So if you look at all indicators after the famine in Ireland, what you see is the lot of the average Irish person, I know this doesn't sound good in our history books because it goes against our narrative history, improved dramatically in the late 19th century. So much so that the position of workers in early 19th century Ireland was miles better than the position of workers in 1850. So the upswing, but it was to do with the
end. Yeah, I understand.
It was to do with people leaving the country or dying. Same thing in the Black Death, right? And if, for example, 20 million Americans step out of the labor market, it has the same impact as 20 million people not being there anymore. Real wages rise and opportunities for those in the labor market go up. So the message from the podcast this week is, if you're looking for a wage increase, go for it right now. Thanks again to all our Patreons. And of course, on Patreon, you get ad-free, you get the course, you get AdMax. And the course is a 14-lecture tour around the world of money, past, present, future, the whole thing. You get the notes, you get the reading list, all that. It's all on patreon.com/David McWilliams.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.